squandered due to an inability to see past these contrivances and learn to be selective based on experience. A truly powerful man jealously guards his most precious resources, his independence and his ability to maneuver. In other words, his options and his ability to exercise them. True power isn't about controlling others, but the degree to which you control the course of your own life and your own choices. Commitment to anything always limits this. When you step through one door, 100 more close behind you. You're free to do what you want, right? You can always quit a job, divorce a wife, change your school, etc. But how many men do you know who are what they are today as a result of their own real doing, unfettered by how their choices impact their girlfriend, wife, kids, parents, etc.? By comparison, how many guys do you know who dutifully stick with a dead-end job that's slowly killing them because it's better than dealing with the consequences and backlash it would have on his family? Are they free to quit? Sure, but not without an impact on their families and relationships. So where does this leave you? You have two paths as I see it. You can explore your options with multiple STRs and, should you decide to become sexually involved, do so while maintaining non-exclusivity with them. Put off and unlearn the expectations you've been conditioned to accept through feminine beneficent, social contrivances, and truly explore your opportunities while bettering your own conditions in anticipation for becoming monogamous at some later point. Or, you can remain in your sense of moral doctrine, no shame in this, and still non-exclusively date and explore your options while you continue to better yourself, with the caveat that you know you'll be limiting your depth of experience. I won't denigrate a decision to opt for this, but far too few religious men have the perseverance to stay objective in their decision to hold out and overlook major character flaws in women they'd like to be their spouse in a furious rush to marry them and get to the sex part. Better to fall short in conviction than to make hurried decisions that will negatively alter your life. Perhaps this isn't even what you're driving at? I don't know if it's a religious conviction or an internalized social contrivance that passes for one that's the cause of your hesitancy. But isn't it interesting that both are so closely associated? I know devout atheists who still believe in the fallacy of the one or the soulmate myth. Most women, and far too many men, look at me as if I denied the existence of God when I elaborate on why I think their eHarmony-induced fantasies of a soulmate are hogwash and psychologically damaging on a social scale. Regardless, whatever your reasons, women should only ever be a complement to a man's life, never the focus of it. When you start living for a woman, you become that woman. Never again compromise your own identity to receive the ever-changing approval she grants you. You have to be the prize at all times, not just while you're single. In fact, it's imperative that you remain so into an LTR. My suggestion to you is not to even entertain the idea of monogamy until you are established in your career for 2 years. After your college is complete, play the field. Do whatever. But do not commit even to a girlfriend. Rather, make a commitment to yourself. Promise yourself you won't allow yourself to let emotionality and conditioned expectations of monogamy dictate what your goals will be or how you'll achieve them. It's called enlightened self-interest. You cannot help anyone until you first help yourself. Plate Theory 4. Goal State Monogamy. Whenever a guy, uninitiated to the concept of spinning plates, reads the theory for the first time, his response is usually rejection of it because it conflicts with what I call monogamy as goal mindset. Understand, this is always going to be a tough stretch for any guy still plugged into the feminine matrix. But it's not limited to them. It's also the natural guy who doesn't have much trouble attracting women. A male-specific monogamy as a goal mindset serves the feminine imperative, but it also has roots in our natural desire for security. So it makes anything even remotely like plate spinning counterintuitive. The feminine imperative pounds into men's collective consciousness over the course of a lifetime that monogamy will cure loneliness, make them responsible, provide them with a constant supply of sex, and a host of other things that assures them it's the right thing to do, and it's in their own best interest. This then leads the more optionless individuals to develop and practice beta methods and rationales in accordance with what they believe and have been told by women is required of them in order to achieve their monogamous intimacy, i.e., the goal of everything. So, understandably, when the principle of being non-exclusive is presented to them in a rational way, instead of a ridiculed way as it's normally passed off as, it conflicts with this perceived path to happiness in monogamy. The very idea that any man would be better off with more options in this area of life, or could feasibly and logistically pull it off, seems foreign. As a counter to this, he makes up rationales as to why it won't work or won't work for him. Logistics. I can't spin plates because I have too little time. I can't manage more than one girl without the other finding out, etc. If you are indeed spinning plates in a healthy, upfront, non-exclusive way, this should never be an issue. There are game-aware men with less time than most who manage 4 to 5 different girls in a week without having them consume all their leisure and business time. I don't suggest that you go this route per se, because for the better part, PUAs rely on a dishonesty in non-exclusivity. However, the reason they are capable of this is because they perfected plate spinning effectively enough to have the plates spin themselves. Most uninitiated betas reason that they must, at all cost, apply a constant effort to each and every individual girl they encounter at risk of losing a good one. Besides this being indicative of soulmate thinking, what they fear is losing a plate because they are unaccustomed to ever having had the leisure to do so. This is evidence of a scarcity mentality that is a result of their monogamy as goal preconditioning. Plate theory necessitates an attitude of fearlessness, not carelessness. Fearlessness. When you're practicing plate theory, your plate should call you. You are the prize and the prince whose time is valuable and sought after. You should be the object of women's pursuit. That said, you still have to make an effort to see them and keep the attention you do apply to them valuable. But this must be done with the attitude that if one plate falls, you're confident in your other options or your ability to generate new options. Personality type. I'm just not like that. I don't want to be considered a playa. I could never do that to a woman. How can anyone be like that? This rationale is a common one, and not limited just to chumps. There are plenty of otherwise confident, positively masculine men who'd still think they owe it to women to allow them to set the frame in their relationships without any fear of competition anxiety. Players are men who are dishonest. They are not spinning plates because they are isolating each plate independent of the other. And this goes back to logistics. Of course you can't find time for anything else if all you do is try to coordinate each individual story with each plate for fear that they discover each other. The plate-spinning man has no need for this, because he never implies exclusivity to any plate. Either they accept this, or they're not a plate to consider. Done in a frank, honest, yet indirect way, you will not be a player, and you will establish yourself as a man whose attention is worth a woman competing for. Women would rather share a successful man than be saddled with a faithful loser. Perfectly sums up plate theory versus monogamy as goal mindsets. Men in general gravely underestimate the power of female competition anxiety and how useful it really is. As I'll illustrate next, women are natural plate theorists. They are accustomed from a very early age to mitigate multiple sex interests. They simply learn how to balance their indirect communications with that anxiety in their own plate spinning. Anxiety in women is good for men, even when they make no effort to use it or would never consider it if they knew its usefulness is always present. Everything a woman does on a daily basis is colored by competition anxiety. Makeup, clothing, shoes. God, the shoes. Indirect communications with men and women, social contrivances, comparing and evaluating dates and possible suitors. Everything is born from this competitive desire to achieve security with the best possible guy and make damn sure the girl next door doesn't get him first. This anxiety is analogous to men's consummate fear of rejection and all of the myriad rationales he'll create and the buffers he'll devise to avoid it. Bear in mind that monogamy is a dictate of the feminine imperative. It is the social contract that the feminine ultimately needs in order to quell a constant desire for security in a very chaotic world. When you are predisposed to monogamy as goal thinking, or trying to break yourself of this, understand that this is a tool of the feminine imperative. That's not to discount the overall merits of monogamy, but it is to make you aware of how it's acculturated into men as a responsibility to providing monogamy. Men who find themselves in a state of internal conflict about abandoning monogamy as goal are really confronting a fundamental shift in their prior feminine conditioning.
Chapter 2
Continued.
Part 3 Plate Theory 5 Ladies' Game
Female Plate Theory. For as often as I've mentioned women being natural plate theorists, I don't often go into detail about it. I think it's pretty well established that I completely disagree with the idea that women will only fuck, or want to fuck, one guy at a time. I could outline several women I know from experience in this. But really, observing behavior will bear this out fairly predictably for most men. I will, however, agree that women are predisposed to, and are socially encouraged to, seek monogamy once convenient. But as in all things female, the talk rarely matches the behavior. Sexuality is a woman's first, best, agency, and even the homeliest women know this. even when they're just complaining about other women using it. The principle is that a woman's first priority is to seek out security. And even when confronted with the duplicity of women's pluralistic sexual strategy, we'd be wise to bear this in mind when evaluating motives for behavior. Their methodology is what's in question here. There is an understandable confusion for guys in this respect. On one hand, women present a constant facade that the fear of being perceived as a slut, i.e., concurrently fucking more than one guy at a time, is primary to their self-respect and respectability. However, this has to be tempered with the desire, both biological and psychological, to experience a variety of men in order to ensure the security, provisioning, from the best among them. So in order to facilitate this, women must practice a kind of calculated hypocrisy that is socially reinforced by the gender as a whole, as well as some men, usually those so optionless as to excuse the behavior in order to get to her sexuality, or guys so conditioned that they overlook it as normal. It is socially acceptable for a woman to blatantly spin plates. Does this sound outrageous? While a woman who makes her sexual practices a bit too overt runs the risk of being perceived as a slut, which is dubious in this age as it is, most relatively attractive women covertly have a constant bullpen of starters ready to go to bat at any one time. These are also known as orbiters. Orbiters are the attention providers, the maybe guys. It makes little difference in terms of available options which she chooses at any given time. The very fact that she has five or six of them pursuing her is enough to boost her sense of self-worth, her social status within her same gender peers, and give her the confidence to drop any one of her plates at a moment's notice for any reason, knowing that two or three more guys, or 20 more on Facebook, stand ready to take his place. No questions asked and prepared rationalizations at the ready. Furthermore, this practice is socially reinforced by women doing the same thing and the social conventions constructed to excuse the behavior. It's the unspoken rule of a woman's prerogative. A woman can always change her mind. This is a powerful tool for women in any situation. If a woman doesn't choose to be sexual, it is necessarily forced or obligated, even when it's after the fact. Either the jerk forced her, physically or emotionally, or she had thought she wanted to, but later reconsidered. It makes little difference. In all social situations, the default is to side with the feminine, the weaker sex, women from sympathy or empathy, and men from a desire to eventually become intimate with them. In either instance, the feminine prerogative is socially reinforced. That's important to understand, because even by my focusing on it here as a male, my motives for doing so become suspect. That's how embedded this dynamic is. To question it, risk ostracization. However, I also understand that for the greater part of women, this plate-spinning dynamic isn't a conscious effort on their part. In fact, I'd suggest that it's so thoroughly recognized that women default to it autonomously. Also, this is a good example of the first principle of power. When you have power, always feign powerlessness. Free reign. So, with a firm understanding that their behaviors will, for the most part, be excused, they are free to practice the feminine form of play theory, unhindered by social reprisal. The feminine plate spinning involves much more than sex, though. Remember, attention is the coin of the realm in female society. The capacity to command attention determines self-esteem, peer status, sexual selectivity, and a host of other factors in a woman's life. So spinning plates becomes more than just a, which guy am I gonna get with tonight, prospect. This dynamic and these factors are what make women natural plate spinners. Even when a woman has no intention of ever becoming sexual with a maybe guy, his attention still has some value to her. It appeals to the long-term perspective for security. It's a continuous subroutine running in her hindbrain. This is the rudimentary psychology behind hypergamy. Now, combine all of this with women's native language, covert communication. And it's natural for a man to assume that a woman will only ever become sexual with one guy at a time. This serves the latent purpose of keeping him in a kind of stasis. If he assumes women will only be sexual under the precondition of comfort and commitment, she is free to spin plates, essentially weighing options, as she pleases and sample at will what she sees as her hypergamic best interest at the time. If the carrot looks good enough, the guy will patiently pull the cart until such time as another, better carrot comes along. Either way, he's in that stasis. If a guy were to see her social and psychological machinations for what they are, he'd never pull the cart. So it serves women best that men think commitment should always be required for intimacy, even in the face of her behavior directly contradicting this. Plate wars. Plate wars. Plate wars. Plate wars. Plate wars. Lastly, this social dynamic serves as a very effective weapon for women against each other. Competition anxiety between women is something men can exploit for their own plate spinning. But the reason it is so useful is because women so readily use it against each other. For a woman to say another woman is a slut translates into an overt betrayal of this unspoken social contrivance. Essentially, she's saying, the rules are that women require commitment for sex. But here's one who'll never be worthy of any guy's commitment because she won't play by the rules you suckers think she will. She is tacitly disqualified for a man's commitment and is, at least in the accusing woman's mind, a reduced threat in this feminine competition. She becomes exposed in the same game they're all playing, and in being so, loses attention and therefore status and personal esteem. It seems petty to guys, but it's really intragender warfare. Think of how many times an exceptionally attractive woman that is completely anonymous to a group of women you happen to be with will berate her based on appearance alone. She must be a tramp if she dressed like that. These are the same women who'll berate a man for basing his estimation of a woman on her outer appearance. This is manifested feminine competition anxiety. Ask a woman to name the most attractive female actress they can think of. Odds are it will be a woman, who is a guy you'd never think of, who presents the least threat of this anxiety. Gentlemen, as I'm fond of saying, women will fuck. They may not fuck you. They may not fuck me. But they will fuck someone. The girl who bangs the hot guy at the foam party in Cancun on spring break within 5 minutes of meeting him is the same girl who wants you to believe that they'll only fuck one guy at a time, and then after commitment. All women are sexual. You just need to be the right guy at the right time for the job.
Plate Theory 6.
scarcity and abundance. Plate theory is for your benefit, not for women's. That might sound harsh, but it's a method intended to increase your value as a commodity that works on two levels. First, the external. By practicing honest, non-exclusive dating, you communicate to your prospective plates that you are in demand. I've gone so far as to tell men to foster this sense by never entering the phone from Friday to Sunday evening, even when they have no other plans. The perception that your attention is sought after increases its value. It's when men are too eager to get with a woman that their attention becomes worthless and interest levels decline. Nothing serves a man better than having three or four women competing for his exclusive attention and fostering in them that feminine competitive anxiety in as subtle and covert a way as possible. Make no mistake, it's a real art that women are all too familiar with themselves in their own intergender dealings. Women are natural plate theorists. They simply use their varying degrees of physical attractiveness to line their plates up. Secondly, plate theory is for a man's own internal benefit. It's much easier for a man to not give a shit if he truly doesn't give a shit. It's far easier to deal with women on the basis of indifference when you have a subconscious knowledge that there are at least three other women who will be happy to have your attention if one plays games with you. The reason men fail most shit tests women give them is because they subconsciously telegraph too much interest in a single woman. Essentially, a shit test is used by women to determine one or a combination of these factors. A. Confidence, first and foremost. B. Options. Is this guy really into me because I'm special, or am I his only option? C. Security. Is this guy capable of providing me with long-term security? By practicing plate theory, your mental attitude will be such, or should be such, that you will pass most shit tests based simply on this practice. Abundant thinking is the root of plate theory. A lot has been written about approaching women, and really life in general, from a position of abundance. People often make the mistake of assuming that having a wide variety of choices tends to cheapen the commodity, and to a degree, this is accurate. But it also allows for a better, learned awareness of which choice amongst the pool is common and which is of higher quality. But Rolo, I'm so busy that I have no choice but to ignore and postpone. They sense it and seek me out. I worry that I'll create crazies. My weekends are jammed. At what point do we stop? This is the best problem you can have. You've successfully flipped the script. You've gotten to a point where it becomes instinctive, and your plates actively seek out your attention. By default, you're creating value by scarcity. At what point do you stop? How old are you? If you're under 30, stay in the game. If you're over 30, stay in the game, but cool things off occasionally. The only time a man should even contemplate monogamy is after experiencing abundance. If you're inundated with women occupying your weekends, consider hooking up with a proven plate on a Thursday evening and reserve your weekends for your other pursuits. Also, don't be afraid to clear your schedule to hang out with friends or do other things that interest you. Remember, scarcity increases value. Too many guys think that plate spinning is something that needs a constant effort. It doesn't. In fact, applying yourself equally across all your active plates only pushes you closer to settling for one or two. Most guys think that they don't have to continually spin their plates. You don't. If you're doing it correctly, they'll spin themselves for you. The anxiety is that if you don't keep applying attention to any one plate, she'll lose interest and fall off. Sometimes this is the case, and you have to be prepared to accept it. Some plates have to break in order to spend more, and that's okay. More often than not, however, your scarcity will create value and mystique. Thus, they will pursue you for their affirmation. Plate theory, of course, can be a means to an LTR, but bear in mind that it's essential that you practice it long enough and effectively enough to determine what a quality woman means to you and how to recognize her. As with most game skills, the uninitiated will use them to some degree of success up to the point that he finds his idealized girl of his dreams and launch into a self-destructive LTR because his idealization was based on juvenile impressions rather than a mature understanding of what a quality woman's characteristics are. This is all due to a lack of concrete experience. Spin plates for as long as possible, because once you do commit to an LTR, even with the tightest of game, you will lose a measure of the competitive anxiety that made your attentions valuable to any one woman. All of your plates fall off, and the girl you're engaged in an LTR with gets too comfortable. This is the root of why men find that the woman they had hot, sweaty monkey sex with when they were dating becomes more sexually reserved a few months after they're a couple. The competitive anxiety is relieved, and therefore sexual frequency and quality is no longer a proving trait for her. That's not to say there aren't methods to stoke this anxiety in an LTR. But, by comparison to being single, the frame of the relationship doesn't have to be contested when she and you understand that she is your only source of intimacy and sex. In a committed relationship, you simply cannot spin plates.
Chapter 3, Part 1. Plugged In. Average Frustrated Chump. In the community, there's a lot of want for better terms. One of the major obstacles in the average guy's path to unplugging from his conditional interpretations of gender relations is really coming to terms with the terms we use. Somewhere on the net, I'm sure there's a glossary of common acronyms used in the manosphere outlining the various shorthand we use. Some of these terms have gone mainstream, and I'm beginning to see even legitimate online journalists use LTR, long-term relationship, or ONS, one-night stand, somewhat regularly. Meaning, there's a common perception that others will already know what they mean. The reason this is an obstacle for a lot of plugged-in guys is because it seems almost juvenile, like a treehouse club for preteen boys. For me to draw comparisons of an acculturated, feminine social paradigm to the central plot of the Matrix movies, admittedly, that seems kind of silly. It's an apt comparison and a useful allegory when you understand the concepts behind it. But for a guy just coming to grasp it, while being immersed in a feminine primary socialization for his whole life, it doesn't click. And predictably, women invested in that same socialization see the terminology as little more than little boys holed up in their treehouse, throwing rocks at the girls below. However, like any new developing science or art or technology, there is always going to be a need to codify abstract concepts. We lack better terms, so we're forced to create new ones to represent new concepts. The AFC, Average Frustrated Chump, was coined almost a decade ago with the mystery method. It's seen a lot of modifications over the years, becoming almost synonymous with the use of the term beta, beta male, or herb, herbivorous male. In fact, although I use it often, I rarely read AFC and PUA blogs, forums, or the community at large. Regardless of the terminology, the concept is really the crux of the term. Most AFCs,
Most guys looking in from the outside can relate to the idea of what an average frustrated chump is. They can identify with it. Once they begin unplugging, the AFC idea comes into better focus and, usually with some discomfort, they realize how that term applies to themselves. Qualities of an AFC. One-itis, first and foremost. Subscribes to feminized idealizations. Supplication is supportive. To comply with gender equalism, she must increase, so he must decrease. Relational equity is the basis of a rational relationship. The savior schema. Reciprocation of intimacy for problems solved. The martyr schema. The more you sacrifice, the more it shows devotion. The friend's debt. LJBF. Let's just be friends. And the pseudo-friendship as a means to prospective intimacy. Primarily relies on dating and social skills, or lack thereof, developed during adolescence and early adulthood. A behavioral history that illustrates a mental attitude of serial monogamy and the related insecurities that accompany it. A belief that women infallibly and consciously recognize what they want and honestly convey this to them, irrespective of behaviors that contradict this. Uses deductive reasoning in determining intent and bases female motivations on statements rather than objectively observing behavior. Believes women's natural propensity is for rational rather than emotional thought. An over-reliance on rejection buffers. A belief in the identification myth. The more alike he is, or can make himself, with his idealized female, the better able he will be to attract and secure her intimacy. Believes that shared common interests are the only key to attraction and enduring intimacy. Believes and practices the not-like-other-guys doctrine of self-perceived uniqueness, even under the condition of anonymity. Considers LDRs, long-distance relationships, a viable option for prolonged intimacy. Maintains an internalized belief in the qualifications and characterizations of women that coincide with his ability or inability to attract them. Thus, he self-confirms the "she's out of my league" and the "she's a loose slut" mentalities on the fly to reinforce his position for his given conditions. Harbors irrational, often socially reinforced, fears of long-term solitude and alters his mindset to accommodate or settle for a less than optimal short-term relationship, often with lifelong consequences. The AFC will confirm a belief in egalitarian equality between the genders without consideration for variance between the genders. Ergo, men make perfectly acceptable feminine models, and women make perfectly acceptable masculine models. Due to societal pressures, he unconsciously self-affirms androgyny as his goal state. This is anything but a comprehensive list. There are far more. But my intent here isn't to provide you with a list of criteria that qualifies an AFC. You might be a chump if. Rather, it's to give you some basic understanding to clarify the term and round out the idea of what an AFC is. Needless to say, these mental schema are some of the impediments to unplugging, or helping another man unplug, from his old way of thinking. As I'm fond of repeating, unplugging chumps from the matrix is dirty work. Expect to be met with a lot of resistance, but understanding what dynamics you may harbor yourself or those that a friend might cling to will help you in moving past these years of social conditioning. It's thankless work. And more often than not, you'll also be facing a constant barrage of shit test from both women and feminized men, and ridicule in your efforts. Be prepared for it. Unplugging chumps is triage. Save those you can. Read last rites to the dying. In the next few sections, I'll be explaining some of these plugged-in qualities in more detail. Playing friends. Women have boyfriends and girlfriends. If you're not fucking her, you're her girlfriend. Rolo, how do I get out of the friend zone? Never allow yourself to get into it. Women have used the LJBF, let's just be friends, rejection for 100 years because it serves an ego preservation function for her. To a greater or lesser degree, women require attention, and the more they have of it, the more affirmation they experience, both personally and socially. The LJBF rejection is a social convention that has classically ensured a woman can reject a man yet still maintain his previous attention. It also puts the responsibility for the rejection back on his shoulders, since should he decline the offer of friendship, he is then responsible for entertaining this friendship. This, of course, has the potential to backfire on women these days, since the standard AFC response will be to accept an LJBF rejection in the mistaken hope of proving himself worthy of her intimacy by being the perfect surrogate boyfriend, fulfilling all her attention and loyalty prerequisites with no expectation of reciprocating her own intimacy. I should also point out that this situation is analogous to men using women as fuck buddies, fulfilling all his sexual availability needs with no expectations of reciprocating commitment. Needless to say, this merely positions the new friend into being the emotionally supportive beta counterpart to the indifferent alpha she'll consistently bang and then complain about, also popularly known as the emotional tampon. The LJBF rejection also serves as an ego preservation for her, in that having offered the false olive branch of friendship to him in her rejection, she can also sleep that night knowing that she, and any of her peers, won't think any less of herself. After all, she offered to be friends, right? She is absolved of any feelings of personal guilt or any responsibilities for his feelings, if she still wants to remain amiable with him. Men get a LJBF rejection because of a process. These are the friends first mindset guys. The guys who put far too much emphasis on a solitary woman and wait her out until the perfect moment to attempt to escalate to intimacy, at which point her most comfortable rejection buffer is to LJBF. This is made all the more easy for her because of the process the guy used to get to that point. Sniper mentality. Virtually all guys who get to the point of an LJBF rejection come to it because they fall in line with some variation of what I call a sniper mentality. They patiently wait for their one target, to the exception of all others, constantly attempting to prove their quality in doing so, meaning they emphasize a comfort level and try to be friends before lovers. In essence, they believe that desexualizing themselves will make them more attractive by virtue of not being like other guys, because they bought into the idea that a woman must be comfortable with them first before they initiate intimacy. Once the AFC gets to a point where he's mustered enough courage to initiate, and he feels she should be comfortable enough to appreciate him as boyfriend material, the sniper takes his shot. The problem with this process is that it bypasses essential stages of attraction and the necessary discomfort and sexual tension necessary for intimacy, and proceeds directly to a warm, familiar, comfortable, and ultimately anti-seductive rapport, the exact opposite of arousal. If you think about this in terms of sex, this is the stage right after climax, when she wants to cuddle, spoon, and be wrapped up in her nice, secure, oxytocin-induced comfort. This is the opposite of the testosterone-fueled, sweaty, anxious, and uncomfortable stage of arousal and intercourse before that release. So in terms of friendship and the sniper mentality, you've skipped arousal and gone straight to comfort. You're perceived as a stuffed animal she can hug and then put back on the bed. Thus, when that previously platonic stuffed animal uncharacteristically gets a hard-on and says, "I think we ought to be intimate," her reaction is to think that everything you've done for her up to that point has been a grand ruse. My God, all you wanted was sex this whole time? Her most predictable response is then the LJBF rejection. The field has already been tilled by you. It's only one very easy step for her to stay in that suspended comfort. Can't we just be friends? And then the cycle repeats. The AFC believes the LJBF is a genuine offer, not a rejection, and then falls back into the sniper mentality. He mustn't have been convincing enough to prove his worth to her, and therefore returns to further proving himself as the perfect boyfriend until he once again presses his intent of intimacy after another period. All this goes on apace until she becomes intimate with a real boyfriend, and or he acquires a new target after realizing his efforts with the LJBF girl aren't bearing fruit. The friend zone. The problem with a lot of the friend zone advice women tend to offer is that they cast doubt on whether an LJBF rejection is in fact a rejection and not a genuine offer of friendship. To which I'll say, the only reason the friend zone is such a common issue among men and women for so long is because it's been repeated so regularly and the outcome so predictable as a rejection. A woman's behavior is always the only gauge of her intent, and thus when a rejection like LJBF has been so consistently met with the same outcome and behavior, as evidenced by millions of identical stories from men, it's only prudent for a man to behave in kind. A man's default response should always be to excuse him from the LJBF situation. The reason for this is because it serves his best interest whether she is testing him or is rejecting him. If he is confident enough in himself to walk away from the sexually tense environment, he proves himself as decisive enough to put himself above being played like this. Ergo, he leaves her with the impression that he is the prize, possibly has contacts with better prospective women, and is confident enough to take away his attentions from her, and thus passes any shit test she might have implied, while placing the responsibility of a reconnection on her, where it should be anyway. If she has in fact had a change of heart, her prerogative, remember, and is using the LJBF as a means to reject him, he still benefits from all of the above and plants the seed of doubt in her about her initial estimation of his acceptability for her intimacy. Even if she is truly not interested in the guy, he walks away on his feet and not his knees. By playing friend with her and wasting still more time that could be far better spent with more productive prospects, it is one of the few win-win game situations for a guy to make a wholesale withdrawal of his attentions when he is confronted with an LJBF. Women know all too well how an LJBF places social pressure on a guy to accept what basically amounts to an ultimatum of negative social proof. And that's a hell of a shit test, no matter what her real intent is. If the guy turns down her offer of friendship, he's the dickhead, not her. But the guy that can do what common sense and gut instinct points out to him will be the one to succeed. With her, other women, and himself. Confrontation. Human beings' natural inclination is to avoid confrontation. When a man makes an approach to intimacy with a woman, this becomes confrontational. If she is unsure of a man's sexual acceptability for her intimacy, she must resort to psychosocial, learned behaviors to diffuse this confrontation. Preferably, these techniques should be reinforced beforehand and proven to diffuse just such a confrontation. Thus, the LJBF response is acted out through generations of women across many different cultures. Quite simply, it works more often than not. You can also apply this to the boyfriend disclaimer. Women who not so nonchalantly weave into their casual conversation that they have a boyfriend in a preemptive effort to diffuse a potential suitor's interest. It's basically a proactive LJBF rejection. She reads your telegraphed intent and prevents your further pressing for a date. It's the guy who is unwilling to accept these conventions that makes the most lasting impressions of confidence with women. It goes against what our common human heritage dictates for us. Avoid conflict. Don't make waves. Be her friend, etc. By not accepting an LJBF, you emphatically make known that you are good at confrontation. You have an understanding of her motives, and you're confident enough in yourself to make it known. Not only does this impress her with potential for security provisioning, it also implies future confidence. The problem for most guys is enacting this and making it a default behavior when our biology would have us move away from conflict rather than engage in an unacceptable social dynamic that is subtly damaging to his own interest. Letting go of invisible friends. LDRs are not relationships. I'm sorry to break this to you, but there is no such thing as a long-distance relationship. LDR. That's correct. You have no relationship. An LDR simply does not meet the criteria necessary for it to be considered a legitimate relationship. There is no reciprocity of anything more than words passing over a phone line or an instant message text. Understand me here. You have no relationship. You have self-assumed accountability, self-assumed liability, and internalized responsibilities to be loyal to this person, this idealization, in your head. You are entertaining a commitment to fidelity with an idealization and ignoring what everyone outside of your LDR will regularly tell you is insanity. LDRs are one of the more insidious forms of one-itis. LDRs are the most easily identifiable form of one-itis, and it would be laughable if it weren't so damaging to a guy's life maturation. The LDR man generally sacrifices years of his life in this pitiable effort to pursue his soulmate across the planet or even 100 miles away. The very thought of refuting the idea that an LDR can work is equitable to denying his belief this fantasized one-itis-fueled idealization that he's swallowed for the better part of his life. It's easy to criticize an LDR in the terms of questioning either party's earnestness and fidelity in entertaining an LDR, and this is usually the tack that most people giving advice on LDRs follow. One or both parties are or will cheat on the other over the course of time. It's true. But LDRs are far more telling of a mentality that results in much more damaging consequences as a result of deeply conditioned self-expectations and fears. I can't begin to list the number of otherwise intelligent and ambitious men I've known who've drastically altered the course of their lives to follow their one. Men who've changed their majors in college, who've selected or switched universities, men who've applied for jobs in states they would never have considered, accepted jobs that are substandard to their ambitions or qualifications, men who've renounced former religions, and men who've moved across the planet, all in an effort to better accommodate an idealized woman with whom they've played pseudo-boyfriend with over the course of an LDR, only to find that she wasn't the person they thought she was, and were depressive over the gravity that their decisions played in their lives. An LDR is akin to an LJBF, but writ large and festering in a man's life. You play surrogate boyfriend, voluntarily accepting and internalizing all of the responsibilities and accountabilities of being a woman's exclusive, monogamous partner with no expectation of reciprocating intimacy or sexuality in the immediate future. However, an LDR is worse than an LJBF arrangement since it pervasively locks a man into a success or failure mentality with regards to the relationship actually being legitimate. After all, she's agreed to remain his girlfriend from miles away. And if he's the one to falter, it's his lack of perseverance and this one-itis ego investment that dooms them. Once the LDR inevitably ends, he's the one left with the self-doubt. He's the one beating himself up over wasting time, money, and effort. And he's the one feeling guilty whether he or she is the true cheater. Invisible friends. An LDR is like having an invisible friend with whom you're constantly considering the course of your actions with. Consider the personal, romantic, familial, educational, career, personal maturity, and growth opportunities you've limited yourself from or never had a chance to experience because of this invisible friend. When you finally divorce yourself from this invisible friend, will it have all been worth it? Guys cling to LDRs because they've yet to learn that rejection is better than regret. AFCs will nurse along an LDR for years because it seems the better option when compared with actually going out and meeting new women who represent a potential for real rejection. They think it's better to stick with the sure thing. But it's the long-term regret that is the inevitable result of an LDR that is life-damaging. Nothing reeks of desperation or verifies a lack of confidence more than a guy who self-righteously proclaims he's in an LDR. Women see you coming a mile off because you are a guy without options, clinging to his one previously realized option. In fact, the only reason a man entertains an LDR is due to a lack of options. If you had more plates spinning, an LDR would never look like a good idea. And finally, it's not uncommon to see the not-in-my-case defense offered about how you actually do see your invisible friend once every 4 or 6 months. To this, I'll say, again, what opportunities are you censoring yourself from experiencing by playing virtual, long-distance house with a woman you only see this often? Do you honestly think you're the exception to the rule? The truth is, you're molding your lifestyle around what you hope your relationship will be in the future. That's no way to live.
Chapter 3 Continued, Part 2.
Enter White Knight. The following was a timely question by a So Suave forum member. Just wanted to find out, who do you talk about aspects of game with off-site? I'm talking here about game in the broadest sense of the term, so pick up.